So are there special ways that you've dealt with the passing of people? Were there new rituals invented to cope with that, the way that people, you know, had weddings that were completely different from how their parents did it?
No, but we're going to invent...
Ceremonies and rituals, give me the heebie-jeebies.
We're going to invent one.
I want nothing to do with them. That was enough. I feel allergic after all the ceremonies that we had on the ranch were kids.
What kind of ceremonies?
Some people were really into paganism. Some people still are.
Oh, yeah, we could
hear. But there's just a long discussion and people trying to hash things out and people trying to be, like, into, like, and unanimous decisions and obviously coming from very different viewpoints about certain topics. And I don't know. I also feel like I just sat through too many ceremonies that were people where people were sort of quasi-religious. And I, for me personally, I had no connection to that and I felt like I wanted out of the room. And I know that, you know, ritual is really important to some people. It's just not to me. I think I have the wrong personality type for it.
Yeah, but how do you want to die, Jen? How do you want to be buried? What's the ritual we're going to start with?
I want to be tossed in the woods and rot. You know how Night Eagle got to die. Like, he got the ravens ate him for a while, the ravens and the vultures, because no one found him for a few days. I think that's perfect.
Well, I think that's an ideal. That's like an ideal that a lot of people hold up, but it's just not going to happen.
It's not super legal. But, yeah, I mean, I'm okay with that. Like, I don't need a ceremony once I'm gone. I'm gone. The only people that are worried about me are the people that I left behind, so they can do whatever they want.
Who was Night Eagle?
He was married to Deborah for a while, and before that he was with somebody named Crescent, I think. But they were up on the ridge.
A theologist. He was an interesting guy. He lived near us. He must have been just out hiking or looking.
He had a cabin pretty far out.
Okay.
And he was getting older and he was not physically well. And he keeled over watering his garden. And somebody went looking for him who he worked with a few days after he didn't show up for work and went out there and found him. And I think this is how the story goes. This is about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But the birds had gotten at him pretty well. Which, you know, we take a lot of energy from the planet. So that's the start of putting it back in.
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting segue into, I know you're asking the questions, but Jen has a lot of opinions about how the impact that people that live on the land have on the land, and like how it's not necessarily like the most respectful way of treating the land. And I don't know, did you want to say something about that?
I don't know if you're going to like present, but I mean, I don't know, Dad and I were talking about this the other day, how a lot of that back to the land movement was a way of like kind of retreating, kind of like the modern preppers, where people are like, oh man, just gotta get away from it all and go, you know, leave the big bad world and I'm gonna just retreat and take care of myself. You know, and that was a way to step away from all the responsibilities of that time. You know, things were chaotic politically and, you know, stepping away from that maybe felt good or safe. You know, you just raise your kids and do your thing. But it did sort of step away from the responsibilities of making a better world for ourselves. And it's probably the most impactful thing we could do is put all those roads in place and build more roads and take water from those upland streams. So we used to have steelhead moving up into those creeks, and we don't anymore because of all of the water that people have taken out through the years, and especially all those pot gardens in the upper watersheds. So it's been incredibly damaging to this county, that back to the land movement, in terms of ecological integrity.
And you're a biologist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So was your study of biology informed by your upbringing at all?
In some ways. I mean, I think it's different to look at the land as a resource that you live on versus looking at the land in terms of a whole landscape and a landscape that's connected. I think as a kid, unless, you know, it's something that you do, unless your parents are maybe biologists or ecologists or something like that, you don't have those conversations. But definitely I felt like I was more connected to the land having grown up on it and understanding and loving the trees and loving the streams and loving, you know, the landscape itself. And I think that really led to some of my studies.
And you had some older parent like figures in the community that also had the same love of the land that sort of connected with to maybe more after you
I don't know
went
if you've
to school.
Interviewed Mika Wawona or Linda Gray. They're really bright women. And one of the things that Linda and Mika have both said is that really initially what we should have done when people moved to the land was to cluster themselves so that their impacts were much more limited. So that you have, you know, 10 houses really tightly clustered to each other, and then you don't have 25 miles of road going to everybody's houses. And because, you know, most of the streams in the county are degraded due to sediment from the roads, and that smothers the fish eggs and kills all the fish. So we lose our coho, we lose our chinook, we lose our steelhead, and everything else, you know, like the frogs. So we could have prevented some of that damage by having fewer roads. And so they knew this, they just couldn't get that to happen. So super bright women who cared a lot about the integrity of the landscape.
Well, people just moved up there and they're like, as long as I don't see my neighbor, that's the point, right?
Right. And some of the bylaws up there are that you're not supposed to build your house and all your structures so that everybody has to look at it. I understand that urge. I really don't want to always see everybody. I want some privacy.
As kids, I'm not sure if you two were involved in crafting the bylaws or in the governance meeting.
Way too little.
But wasn't Kirsten, didn't she get on the board pretty young, or Lasara?
Kirsten Johnson did. I think Lasara Scott
young.
Did.
Like in their teens, their late teens.
Yeah, but the bylaws were pretty well written by the time we were in our teens. But we did attend lots of board meetings as kids. That's part of playing in the barn, was trying to figure out what to do while the parents were talking for 6 hours about bylaws or this or that, or trying to sort out some of the things that, you know, when you're idealistic and you're moving to the property, you think everything's going to work great. It's like going into any agreement with people, right? You think you've thought of everything and everyone's going to behave their best. And then you find that there's things you didn't anticipate or people who don't behave how you expected them to. So the meetings were sometimes really long. That's what I remember about them.
Yeah, torturous. Yes, I know. And Dad was on, and Juanita both were on the board for a while. And I remember just the stories when they would come home too about, oh my God, so and so going on and on and on. I wish they could, you know. It's hard to make decisions like that about the community you live in when everyone is so very vehemently passionate and, like, their opinion is the most important thing.
There were some times, like, so now the board is really functional. Everybody really likes working together. They get a lot done. They go to their meetings. They have their jobs. They do their jobs. Done. But there have been times in the past where it was really contentious. There were topics that were really contentious or people that were really upset, or sometimes it's about people that are misbehaving, and sometimes it was substance abuse related, and sometimes it was just
financial.
having a different financial. So it's sort of like a, you know, an oscillating sine wave where, you know, sometimes it's really easy and sometimes it's hard, and I think that's also part of community.
One of the decisions that I think more the Radical Ridge people had to come to financial is an interesting one about the roads. So before there was a bridge, which is made out of a railroad car that crosses between a narrow part of
Eldridge Creek.
Oh, it's Eldridge Creek. And so before that was put up all winter long, you basically had to have two cars. Have you heard about this system that we used to have?
Oh, God, it was terrible at certain points.
So I remember distinctly in carpools, like, remember in Patty's, she had a VW Bug, and we had, like, six kids in the car. And she's like, oh, I think we can get through this, the creek. And so getting into the water and the water coming up to right below
the windows.
Where the windows were. And she's like, we got this. And she just, like, step on it. And, you know, it's, like, only a small part that is that deep. But so we get through and, you know, come out on the other side.
It sort of floated downstream a ways.
Yeah. So the memories as kids, I know, is probably more dramatic. But so many years of doing that. And then, like, it wasn't passable at a certain point. They had to put a tram in where it was a double, like, two-seater back-to-back seat that you pull yourself across. on a
train. Sometimes we had to do it by ourselves, and I felt like I was too small to do it.
Dad would sometimes be like, I can't do all these loads. I have, like, 3 loads of groceries and all the laundry, so Jen, just get in there and pull yourself across. And she's had, like, a load of laundry on the other
little 8-year-old going, this is too big!
I mean, yeah, I remember.
So you'd have a car on each side of the creek, and so you'd go to town in one car, and you'd go home in the other car.
So, at some point, they realized that was just, like, not feasible. It was not sustainable.
I think it was 1981 they did it.
And the Ridge decided to buy that railroad car. Mm-hmm. And it was quite expensive for, like, people that a lot of people didn't have careers that, you know, were financially lucrative. So, I don't know, did the ranch help pay for that too? There's got to be. Our dad probably knows that story. But when that went in, man, we upgraded big time.
Being able to cross the creek year round.
Yeah. Yeah. That was an amazing
upgrade. Nowadays, there would be a lot more California Department of Fish and Wildlife involved in that kind of work.
Yeah.
Back then, they just kind of did stuff. Another reason that maybe there was a lot of impact from people living up on the land there.
Yeah.
What is the firefighting story?
Oh, just one of them.
One of them.
Well, summertime, everybody would hang out at the Common Land Pond because it's a really beautiful, nice, cool pond. But everyone would hang out naked. And so you'd hang out, you'd have watermelon, you'd picnic, whatever. And then there was one time somebody came ripping down the hill.
Running down the steep hill, yelling, there's a fire in Sisters Ridge. Everyone, we need all hands on deck kind of thing.
And everybody loaded into their trucks and threw their boots on and grabbed their shovels and stuff.
Dad didn't want to leave us at the when there was a fire on the ranch.
Yeah, so everybody roared up the hill. Yeah, sorry.
He would be fine. I don't know how many kids can say that they've been left in the car while their dad was fighting a fire about 50 feet away from them.
Like, a little grass fire, though.
There was a big group of adults just running around
mostly naked. Fire.
And Dad, as he leaves the car, says, girls, stay in the car.
I think the firefighters that arrived that day were very bemused. But yeah, the firefighters did come from town.
Sketchy times.
Yes.
Yeah.
What do you do now?
I am a nurse practitioner, midwife, and I work... For many years, I worked in community health centers catching babies and doing the classic, like, midwife job in community health centers. Partly, I chose that career, also influenced by my upbringing. Being surrounded by birth and people just having babies at home and kind of having an intrigue about the human body at a young age, I think, when I saw, like, Lynn would do her visits in the ranch house, and I'd be like, what's she doing? And then finding out, like, one time we were down at Haven and Roberts, and someone was giving birth. Don't know who it was.
Vivian.
And my instinct, all the kids were like, let's play. There's lots of hours to play. But my instinct was like, Marie, how can I help? Can I bring her food? Can I bring her lunch? So I was kind of intrigued because I wanted to get in that room and I wanted to see what was going on. I'm like, a baby's going to be born? So, I kind of thought it was a very, not a legitimate career to be a midwife because, you know, all these women are just having babies in the house and, you know, kids are playing and who knows, the kids didn't even know the woman who was having a baby. But then during... when I was in undergrad, I met someone she said she was going to become a midwife. And I was like, really? That's a career? So I started to pursue that in my head. It was like really thinking about women and children and feminism and kind of like how to incorporate all of that. And so finally got to nursing after a few steps.
But not sort of the hippy-dippy type. Gwen went to Yale and studied nurse midwifery there at Yale.
And now I work at Planned Parenthood, and I am all about family planning and like helping women have babies when they want to have babies and keeping the population down. I mean, helping women have babies when they want to have babies, families.
So did you ever deliver babies on Greenfield?
No.
No home deliveries?
No. The only like true like delivery besides Edward and Austin and the Faxons, cows being born and seeing that born, was when our little sister came along. We were in our teens, and she, our stepmother, had a kid. And seeing her born was like, that's cool, that's weird, that's what I think I'm interested in. That is so interesting.
That was at the Fort Bragg Hospital.
Yes.
Whereas I was like, no way, I don't want anything to do with that. That looks like it hurts a lot, and it's messy.
Yeah, where I was like, how is that possible?
What was it about the experience that was so captivating for you?
Well, I mean, it was just like, I think now as a midwife and seeing kids see, and actually just anybody see birth for the first time, or I think I'm really intrigued by how blown away they are by it. It's just this like a neat human experience of like, this honoring this power in women and just how amazing that is. And it's a special moment. It's not like something that happens all the time. And the fact that this 10 centimeter thing can fit out of something that does not usually 10 centimeters and that the body is that malleable. It just, I think there's this awe of the body doing that, that it's a neat thing. It's a neat, but also like exhausting experience.
How old were you when you first saw it?
Well, when my sister was born, I was 15, but I know being around birth, we were like 8, 7. And then we knew so many people that were born at home. Just so many people were home birthed. So we just, yeah, it was a pretty normal thing.
You've talked a little bit about how the attitude towards young women was problematic, but I'm wondering if there was a cultural attitude about birth that helped inform this, and if it was, because it sounds like there was a cultural atmosphere of people just getting born like it was totally normal.
Right.
There were some very strong women up on the ranch.
Yeah.
The stuff about young women is different, like that was a different sort of part of the culture, but there were a lot of very strong women who were leaders in the community, and for them, I think that was one of the things that they wanted to make sure that women could do.
Yeah, and I think there was a lot of respect for, I think there was more respect than in the general community for these women who are having babies up there and, you know, broadening the families and growing families, I should say. And yeah, it's a good point, Jen.
We had some really good women role models.
Yeah.
Can you talk about them, or did you already when you talked about Linda and Mika?
I didn't get to know them as much until I was a little bit more of an adult. I mean, I always liked Mika because she's outspoken and really articulate and definitely a strong advocate for things that I care a lot about. And Linda, I've gotten to know a bit more since I came back here in 2012. And getting to know just this person who is steady and dedicated and also very intelligent and just kind of tirelessly advocating for things that she thinks are important in terms of environmental integrity. Lynn Meadows, I don't know if you got to interview her. She's hilarious. She's very bright, more probably of Gwen's role model than mine, but also like just intelligent, does her thing. She could convince anybody to do anything.
smart. So yeah. Like a big leader. I mean, when you think about the leaders on the ranch, I think a lot of them were women.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some male. I mean, it was very.
There's some like radical women like Sequoia who was just kind of out there earth firster. And then our neighbors growing up were really strong grounding people for us. So Rita Ramey, Susie Bridwell.
Both of them were kind of like aunts.
Yeah.
Parents, like very nurturing, and
they made really good food.
Yes.
They made their own tortillas.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Marie cared for us a lot, but they moved away. Some, you know, things shifted around. If things hadn't shifted, life would have been perfect. If Edward and Austin and the Vaxons hadn't left.
Well, like everything seems easy when you're a kid in that way.
One thing about where we lived is on the ridge, which is a little more isolated. The rest of the ranch had, I think, a little more cohesiveness. Like where the Mervines and the Kramers and you know, Chickenfoot and that whole area, people are a lot closer, mm-hmm. and there are a lot more families. And I think that we would have had more people that we were close to as kids, but we were sort of isolated up on the ridge. We had a different way that we come in and out the ranch. And then when we went to school, we ended up in classes with a lot of these kids. And, you know, there were at least in every age group, there were probably 5 kids of every age group. So there were, like, at Mountain Meadow, the Waldorf school, there were at least 3 to 5 kids in each class. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of the ranch kids went to the Waldorf school.
What was the shift that you mentioned?
Oh, people moving, you know, I mean,
people getting jobs in town, kids growing up and sort of realizing that they're boys and girls, and so you're supposed to be into different things. And
but at the same time, you know, back to like that community and like, you know, separate but still the heartstrings are connected. Like when we're in high school or any of schools in town, like you have a special bond with these people, you know, no matter what, even if you're not friends with them. And it's just a special bond. You look at each other and you're like, we know, you know, what your life is like. I know you understand me. Because a lot of people in town didn't quite understand, or like there was a lot of stereotypes about who we were, where we came from. And, you know, we got, you know, some stereotype names.
We were hippie kids from the ranch.
But that's people all. People didn't really know a lot about it.
I think there were other communities that had similar families coming out of the hills.
A city kid, mm-hmm. you know, you don't know what it's like to, you know, just to get to school is like a half an hour trip drive on a crazy road. And that getting up and having to build the fire to make the water heater run so I could take a shower. I did, you know.
For a while we had a Mexican hot water heater, which was basically like a converted. Paloma. No, before that.
Oh.
It was a converted gas tank, like a propane tank, the upright ones that had like a welded in fuel or burn area, and then the water was in the top, and then there was a pressure release valve at the top, so we had to light the fire and let it burn for a half an hour before we could take a shower.
As a teenager, you take a shower before you go to school. And so I would get up very early to do that, make that happen. So
some people would.
So do you think that the Back to the Land movement has affected the culture of Mendocino County? And you talked a little bit about the environmental awareness. So do you see any lasting impacts or changes in attitude on that front?
I think most of the marijuana growers in the 70s were Back to the Land. And yes. Probably the marijuana cultivation came from that movement.
It used to be a hippie thing. Then it became sort of a redneck thing, a part of the Green Rush. And sort of a rippy thing, redneck hippie.
When was the Green Rush?
That's a good question. So I left for about 15 years or 20 years. Like, I wasn't around that much. But I feel like a lot of it happened then. So, like, the mid-90s got really big, especially with medical marijuana becoming legal in California, but then
that happened in
I feel like in the 2000s though. It just took off and got really ugly.
Like ugly how? Like the grows and forests?
Bulldozers, and not just grows and forests, but landowners just bulldozing large areas and making big hoop houses, and in the last 10 years it seems like it's even worse.
I've had experiences driving up to the ranch feeling, you know, people look at me like, who are you coming up here? So there's this sort of sense it's a bit of a drug culture. This was before, obviously, it was legalized. Actually, I think it was about 5 years ago. I had a really bad experience where someone I didn't recognize.
Someone had come up there and burglarized and beaten the family.
Yeah, yeah. So they didn't recognize me, and this woman like took a picture of my plate and like screamed at me because I was, quote, driving too fast for her, and clearly, it felt to me like this whole drug culture, like protecting our crops, kind of distrust of any outsider. And I'm like, you know, I've been here longer than you have, probably about by 10, 15 years. And I just felt unwelcome in a very strange way. I just didn't like that drug culture feeling up there that happened.
That's a big part of why I don't really want to live up there, is just that so much of it is, it feels like the people that are surviving, that are in our generation up there, are growing in ways that are, I personally, like, as an ecologist, I find unconscionable. But second of all, like, the culture around it, like, really, do you want, is that what you're proud of, is growing? Like, it's not medicine. We all know that, yes, there's medicinal uses, but there's not that many sick people in California. Come on. And I'm really tired. So some of the, like, culture is also about science denial. And some of the culture is also about, like, being insular. And so while there's a lot to be said for tight community, there's a lot to be said for being educated and being well-informed and understanding the world.
That's interesting about the science denial. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's the anti-vaccination movement. There is the chemtrail thing. There's people that insist that climate change isn't real, or that the government is hiding stuff. You know, there's...
Or the...
The chemtrail thing, like, you just can't have conspiracies that big. Like, it's just... No. Or... Not possible.
Like, some people who believe in so much in marijuana as medicine, and, like, deny...
It's magic.
Like, deny modern medicine is helpful. Like, the anti-vaxxers. Yeah. I think that's one of the main issues that people don't utilize enough up there.
I think that there's just a sense that, that's not everybody, but there's a certain, like, culture around Mendocino County where people distrust the government, both on the right and the left, to a point where they deny basic facts. That's a frustrating component of it.
And that's interesting, because what you're describing sounds sort of regressive, and a lot of people I've talked to are really proud of how progressive the Back to the Land movement was. So do you feel like that's kind of a self-made myth, or do you think that there are elements of it that are true?
I think in some ways it's very much a self-made myth. I mean, in some ways, like, it was really revolutionary, and we had a really idyllic childhood in that sense. It was great, and I feel like one of the stronger, like, I feel the stronger for it. Right? Like I feel like I could take on learning what I need to learn in my life and do it. And I think, yes, Gwen and our other sister lives in Alaska, out, you know, way 8 hours down a dirt road. But that myth, I think it's dangerous in any scenario to think that you are the answer. You found the right way to do things. I think it's important to always question yourself
and look outside and see how other people are doing things and how it's impacting the world and how we're impacting each other and the nature around us.
Yeah. I mean, one of the nice things about that movement was that questioning society. But once you become complacent, you stop questioning yourself and you stop questioning anything but what you don't agree with. And that's not progressive anymore.
That kind of sounds like a great place to end, but I'm wondering if you want to end it on a light note, or
I have
you're...
a really funny story. Right when the Facebook was becoming big, and, you know, we'd all were getting on it and kind of more socializing that way, and some article came around that I read that was from some, like, national paper, but magazine, and the Sunday magazine. And I read this whole article, completely fascinating. It was about the marijuana growing in California. And so I read this whole story, and I was like, I posted it on Facebook. I was like, wow, this is really crazy. This is just like how I grew up. So anyway, finally, Jen remembered that she had told some journalist
Didn't just tell him.
But she was like, I'll connect you. You want to write a story? I'll connect you. And so basically, the story was our life. It just was so, the journalist was blindfolded and talked to this person that sounded like our neighbors and then went and it was like literally was our story.
No, and I brought him blindfolded up there.
And so it was just so funny that like I read it and I was like, this sounds really familiar, but oh, that's cool. A lot of people had this experience, but it was our experience. Yeah.
Yeah, my boss read it in DC. So I was working at the Office of Policy in the Office of the Administrator for the EPA, and my boss read it, our article, and he's like, wow, I just read this article. And I was like, that's an interesting article.
But at first, you didn't even realize it.
No.
That's so crazy. But
I have also ran into someone in D.C. at a meeting who, like, saw my Ukiah Natural Foods Co-op little mug. They're like, oh, my mom lives up on this ranch in outside of Ukiah. And we were both at this kind of, like, high-level policy meeting about, you know, product standards or something like that. And I was like, wait a minute. It turns out there were folks that I knew. So I think that the kids from that generation, like a lot of them were curious and motivated people. There's people that are doing really fascinating things out in the world. So I think that overall, like the experience of growing up there was invigorating and positive for a lot of us.
Yeah. Strengthening. It gave us a lot of independent thoughts, ideas, you know, not having television.
Right, like literally we could do what we wanted to pursue without limits.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We just heard from Gwen and Jen Riddell, a pair of sisters who grew up on Greenfield Ranch as children of the Back to the Land experiment.
Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, Story Center, and the Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.